before we begin, we need to answer the question that everyone is going to be asking. And the answer is yes, we did survive the great power outage and server closet fire of ElixirConf 2019.
I actually forgot all that had happened until you just brought it up right now.
How could you forget? That was the highlight. The highlight.
So I was confused. So as Rockwell just said, the power went out yesterday evening. We were actually at dinner. We were eating dinner and the power went out. And they just told us to go because the kitchen staff left.
The computers were down. They had no billing. The kitchen was totally closed. Luckily, we had eaten.
Yeah. So they just told us to go. So the power went out, and yes, we wandered around a bit, hung out with friend of the show Brian and new friend of the show Jake. We ended up going to, I think we ended up going back up to the room around 10:30 and the power was still out. So I plugged my phone in good faith, hoping that the power would come back on and charge it up overnight. And luckily it did. And I think it was maybe around 1 o'clock. All the lights turned on and I woke up and you didn't. So I got up and turned the lights off, which is fine. And then I went back to sleep. I woke up at 6, checked Twitter, and noticed that apparently around 5 o'clock, a couple of floors had been evacuated, but we hadn't. And so I was worried that the fire alarm system was just broke and we almost died. Not the case, though.
Yeah, I was surprised. Usually with those kind of things, it sets off all the alarms in the building. But I guess this place is big enough that maybe they don't do that, and we were spared.
Right. So I think they evacuated 3 floors, and we were one floor out of the window. And I'm kind of glad, though, because I needed that sleep. But yeah, it was just kind of jarring, like waking up like, oh, there was a fire in the hotel and people were evacuated and I wasn't, just waking up to this. But luckily, it wasn't too bad. Because the power came back on eventually later, it caused an issue in a server closet and a computer burned up. So rest in peace.
There was a good joke in the keynote about how they decided to just let it fail.
Oh, yeah, let it crash.
Let it crash.
Let it crash. Yeah, that's pretty funny. The hotel is embracing the let it crash attitude. What's even more wild is that the hotel's completely at capacity, I think, too, because there's more than just ElixirConf here. So the people that got evacuated were talking about how they got outside and they're like, there's only 100 people out here. Shouldn't there be more people?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But we survived and the show goes on. Today is, we're recording on the end of the first day, just prior to the closing keynote. And so we've had the opening keynote and a whole bunch of talks throughout the day. It's been really awesome just meeting people, meeting a few friends of the show. We got to meet friend of the show, Emily.
Oh, yeah.
In person. That was awesome. And been handing out stickers and talking the show up a little bit and just chatting with people. And this is like, for me, I think I've said this before, but this is like the best part is just socializing and seeing what other people are doing and just getting excited about it, you know?
Yeah, it's been awesome for me because I haven't really been around. I've never really gone to any meetups. I've never gone to a conference before. And so Rockwell, I think, has been the only person before yesterday that I met in person that had ever written a line of, well, I guess Paul. So the second person that I ever met in person that had written a line of Elixir, which is wild. So now I've met a bunch more. And it's kind of strange trying to recognize people from their Twitter avatars. So I'm walking around squinting to seeing if there's a passing resemblance.
Trying to do it inconspicuously.
Right. So I walked into the hotel yesterday and this dude was glaring at me and then I figured out it was Rockwell. And the same thing with Brian Joseph. We were walking somewhere and this guy was like giving us a look and I was like, oh, that's Brian. So that's been cool.
So we're recording live in our hotel room and this is pretty cool to do for once. Never done this before.
I think in the entire history of the show, this is the second time. So Paul and I only have recorded in person once at the Spec Studio, and I believe that was with when we had John Gold as a guest. So the entire history of the show, 190 almost episodes, have been all just over the wire. And yeah, it's different. It's cool. It's a lot of newer experiences this weekend. So that's neat. One cool thing is that I've been talking to people and they're always just like, yeah, what do you do with Elixir? You know, and there's like such a wide range of responses, you know, and then I'm meeting a couple of people that have been doing Erlang for a while. And that's always been really interesting too. So hearing about yesterday, we were hearing about how I don't know how long ago this was, but this person had been using Erlang, and I think through NIFS, sort of, through some sort of channel, they were using C++ as well. So they were piping frames from video through their application using C++ to watermark the video and then sending it out back to the other side.
Yeah, and they were saying that that's been running for... They used it to basically circumvent this $20,000 piece of dedicated hardware that would do it. And they wrote it in a couple days, and the thing's been up and running for years, and it's been totally solid.
It was 3 or 4 years. It hasn't... it's been running for 3 or 4 years, and it's fine.
Like, what a wild application of the technology.
Right, and he was saying that they even do some sort of animations as well by frame. They actually... the watermark, they will just animate it frame by frame. And he was talking a little bit about handling disconnections or different kind of failed states. And like, if something happened, they only had a couple of frames or one frame or so before you could actually detect it, which also blew my mind, because you think about it, I don't know what the frame rate of TVs are. It's not 60. It's like 24 or something like that.
It's 29.97, I think. It's just under, it's basically 30.
Right, yeah. So they basically had the time frame of like a couple of frames to have a system that fixed itself before someone would be like, that was weird, you know? So that was really cool. I hadn't really talked to anybody that had ever really used Erlang much. I've only ever observed a few people in the Elixir Slack talk about Erlang, and to me it sounds like... It's like watching Lord of the Rings, almost. It's like they're talking about these archaic systems, or seemingly archaic systems, that... I don't know anything about, have only ever like vaguely heard about, it's very, very interesting to me.
So let's get into it. Let's talk about some of the stuff that we, some of the presentations we saw today. The first, of course, and I think we'll spend a little bit of time on this because it is so cool and so new, is the keynote presentation from Dockyard about their brand new contribution to the Elixir ecosystem.
Yeah, it's actually open. It's up on GitHub as of maybe a couple hours ago. They opened it up. But yeah, so I don't know if people have been seeing around Twitter, but people have been tweeting about pimento cheese, I guess. And
yeah, I totally missed that.
Yeah, and these kind of sort of concentric polygon shapes that are semi-transparent and green. I've been seeing that a little bit too. It's kind of like, I think it's the logo of this project, but... Yeah, so Dockyard officially announced it this morning, and it's called Lumen, and it's basically allowing Elixir to compile to WASM. So you could basically, you could basically have your Elixir compile into WASM and just run natively in the browser.
That's WebAssembly.
WebAssembly, and run in the browser. So. It's been tough for me to wrap my head around this, because only recently I had only ever really heard of WebAssembly because of people I know talking about Rust, and the Rust community has been doing a lot of work in WebAssembly, and so when they announced Lumen, they were talking about so Dockyard, they're sort of like a consulting agency, right? So they work on a bunch of different projects, and Brian from Dockyard mentioned. He was like, so why would we do this? And so there's sort of three different scenarios for the projects that they work on. The first one is sort of, a traditional server-side rendered app, which they use Phoenix for that, right? It's basically as basic as it gets for a web app. Then you have a web app that's server-side, but then you traditionally you might have used like jQuery just to add interactivity to your web app. More recently, you might use maybe Vue or React, but it's not a spot at that point. You're just kind of using it to... add a more like a richer experience to an app, and they're basically using LiveView for that now. With LiveView, and I think as of Friday maybe it was published on Hex. So with LiveView, you can replace some of that stuff you would have used jQuery for, or you would have used some light view or React for. You can do that with just Elixir by using LiveView, because the JavaScript that ships with LiveView will handle the diffing and DOM updates for you. So you basically at that point don't have to write any extra JavaScript to get some basic, but some intermediate interactivity in an app. And then they talked about the third side of things, is like really, really JavaScript heavy client side applications, like, single page applications. And up until that point in their Elixir ecosystem, they've really bought into, they hired Chris to work on Phoenix. they had two of the three bases covered. And so what I think they're doing now with Lumen is they're working on covering that third base. So, and it gets the keynote was hard. It was so in depth and technical. It was blowing my mind the whole time. But they're basically working on covering that third use case where, like, what if you need more than what LiveView can give you and you don't want to have like a collection of LiveView happening and then a bunch of extra JavaScript kind of on top of that. This is where Lumen would come in with WASM or WebAssembly.
Yeah, and it's really interesting some of the technical challenges they had to overcome to even get this. It's still, I think, a proof of concept at this point. But from what I could gather, they are... They talked about a lot of alternatives in terms of like how this could be implemented, where the Beam, this new version of the Beam would run, how you would compile it, how you would deliver the bits to the client. Because I think you said in some cases, like for a simple application, if you're sending the Beam down the pipe, it would be like a 10 megabyte download, which is obviously not tenable for the web. So they talked about ways they could strip it down, because the way you can call things dynamically in Elixir and Erlang using the apply function does not lend itself to tree shaking, as they call it. You're getting purging functions from the binary that aren't called. You can't tell because it's all done dynamically. So they're talking about ways to get around that, limitations on the system, plus all the limitations of JavaScript. Like JavaScript itself is inherently single-threaded. There are web workers, which is sort of its only form of true multi-threaded concurrency in JavaScript currently. So they're leveraging web workers heavily to get that concurrency. There's issues with blocking, with interop, with types, with just all this crazy stuff. And it sounds like they've got a big uphill battle ahead of them to get some sort of compatibility with any existing code.
Yeah, they were talking a lot about that, and it was cool. We'll obviously put links to show notes or links to the video in the show notes. But they talked about, I like that they talked about different approaches they could have taken, why that wouldn't have worked. So, for example, just simply trying to port the Beam over wouldn't have worked because the concurrency model is just different. It's just different. Like Rockwell, you mentioned with the web, you have the main thread and then you have worker threads that spin off. And with the Beam, you have multiple processes. So there's just a mismatch there. I kind of like how they split it up into two sections too. So the first section was talking about actually compiling Elixir to WebAssembly and how that worked. Some of the pain points, like you mentioned, like payload size, like he was saying that you compile the Elixir into the Beam files. The Beam files aren't small. And when you push those into WebAssembly, then basically the browser, like you said, would have to pull down 10 plus megabytes of JavaScript. And that was even just one client library. I think he said Timex maybe is what he tested it on, and it ended up being like 10 megabytes. So obviously that's not great. Code size is huge. Large payloads over the wire, that's not great. Load time is bad, that's not great. And then again, like we mentioned, the concurrency model is just different than the Beam. So that was super interesting to me. And I was sort of following along with the compiler side of things and how they were kind of solving those problems. And they're actually using Rust quite a bit for this. And in the talk, again, we'll link to all this stuff, he specifically mentioned a couple of WebAssembly crates that they use in Rust that sort of make all this possible. And at the end, I believe they talked about wanting to move more of this or as much as they can into Elixir, so that way it's easier and less daunting for Elixir developers to contribute to the project, right? And that was really awesome to me because I've been working on contributing back to the IntellerJ Elixir plugin, but first of all, having to learn Kotlin. And second of all, the JetBrains API is gigantic. So it's like, it's just a huge barrier for me to even contribute maybe a small bug fix, right? So the idea that they're wanting to make this more inviting for contributors is really cool. And then, like I mentioned, they split it into two. And so the second half of the talk was about the runtime. So after things have been compiled, how does the runtime for this stuff work? Let me swing down here. I don't have a whole lot of notes on it because it was just hard for me to follow.
That's a good picture of you totally spacing out at the slides.
Yeah, just staring at the ceiling. It was pretty wild. And again, we'll link to all this stuff. Rockwell was like, "Are we looking at Rust?"
I've never seen Rust before. I didn't know what if I was looking at WebAssembly, if I was looking at Rust, I had no idea.
Yeah. So the talk actually had a demo, which was kind of cool. And really all it did, really the crux of it was showing utilities of spinning up processes through the console or the DOM for that matter. So they actually showed calling a JavaScript function and having that directly spin up Erlang processes and log that to the console. And he even demonstrated the performance of this. So he was like, how about spinning up 10 processes? How fast is that? How about 100? How about 1,000? How about 10,000? And he did like 63. He did what did he say? 64K. He was like, this is basically 64K. And he ran it, and it was running so fast that the browser couldn't keep up with the paint. So the browser was stuttering. And so that was cool. It was all happening in the console, but he was like, all right, well, you know, we don't want people to have to type in the console. That's a developer tool. What about the DOM? And so they had a text input, and he put the number of processes in input, clicked submit, and then the DOM repainted itself with all of the basically the output of the, I think it was process PIDs. It just returned process PIDs, and then how long it took for that PID to complete or return, basically. And so he did the same thing. He put like some ungodly number in there. It was like 10,000, and the page was just updating on the fly, and it was updating faster than he can hit command down to hit the bottom.
That's when you need that scroll to bottom button in the browser.
Right. But it was really cool. It's still even a little bit hard for me to wrap my head around like the actual usage of this. You know, like what this is cool. Like, you know, the interop between the browser and the actual bean processes and being able to spin up processes like that. But on a practical level, like how does, you know, they're building this target, as Brian said, they're building this target. You know, the really JavaScript heavy client side app stuff, and I'm having trouble connecting the dots. Like, how does that WebAssembly stuff get us to that point? And I've actually seen, I feel like I saw more recently, I saw a Rust example where someone had built a front end UI using WebAssembly via Rust as well. And I just haven't dug into it, but it all feels like it's another level.
Yeah, it's still obviously very new and limited, but I think it really hit home for me when they started talking about not the virtual DOM, but updating the DOM and actually using, you know, interfacing with the DOM as if you're dealing with, you know, Elixir processes and I want to say components, but like
supervisors and processes.
Yeah, exactly. And so this really, really reminded me of seeing demos of Scenic. So Boyd Moulter, he couldn't come this year, but when I saw his demos in previous years, when he first demoed Scenic, which is his UI library, each user interface element, whether a button or a text box or a dropdown, whatever, is its own process. And so he did this awesome demo where he literally like crashed a process, you know, crashed the text box or whatever, but the entire state of the form was still maintained. Just that text box was reset because that's the only state that was lost, right? The supervisor for that entire form just restarted the process and it was fine.
Right.
You know, you let it crash and it brought back its state. And, you know, obviously if you wanted to be smart, you could reconstitute that state from some persistence or whatever, but that was a really cool demo and it modeled, you know, processes are really good one-to-one mapping for UI components. And so they started drawing that conclusion with DOM nodes, with, you know, sort of view components, what we think of as VUE, view components, except instead of virtual DOM, they're talking to the real DOM here.
Yeah, so the demo for that, that one blew my mind too, that they had two interactive demos in the first keynote. And if I'm remembering correctly, he loaded up a web page, refreshed it, and in the web console, you saw Elixir compilation output, like you would normally see in a terminal when you start or like recompile Elixir file. And if I'm also remembering correctly, they had a supervisor and they had a bunch of, so basically they had a module and they fed the module like a DOM AST, some sort of representation of DOM. And their module walked the DOM and spun up one process per DOM node and then constructed the HTML in the browser.
Yeah, that's
just in front of me.
Yeah. Then it starts to be like, oh, okay, now you can see how these two things are going to sort of meet in the middle. You've got this concept of the, you know, the document object model and then the underlying functionality of the beam.
Right. Yeah. 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 I think you mentioning like how I think of, you mentioned view components, right? And so I'm thinking of a piece of DOM, maybe not like a element by element level, right? But if thinking about a view component, it's basically a piece of DOM and it holds state. And when the state changes, it updates itself, or, you know, that's the reactive portion of view. But thinking about, processes, right? Thinking about holding a DOM element state in the process, and like you said, let it crash, rebuild itself. And that reminded me of the whole concept of error boundaries, I think they are, with Vue or React or different front-end languages. So I think the quintessential example for the error boundaries that people give is you might have a list component and or like a collection component that is a list of items, and each list in that component is another component, right? So you have a collection component and you have a list item component. And sometimes if something crashes or breaks in the list item component, it'll break the list component too, and it'll travel up the chain and the whole thing will just kind of collapse. And so you can basically construct error boundaries that'll catch so like your controller, your container component would catch a crash, and it would handle that exception at that point, and that would keep the rest of your application from exploding, right? So it's, in my mind, that's almost like isolating a process, right, with a supervisor. The controller or the container component at that point is your supervisor, and it handles the crash of the children that it's supervising.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. I wasn't aware of that, but that does sound like a perfect fit.
It's like my worlds are mending together. It is strange. And you messed me up even more because you're just screwing around. So this has been really cool. One of my favorite things of the conference is that you and I have a notion, and we're for the talks that we go to that are the same, we just take notes in the same document. So we just have a table database of the talks, and then we take notes in there. And you were BSing around with, you know, a hypothetical view component where you did scriptlang equals elixir, and it looked a lot like not even really a gen server, but you're basically like it was basically just holding the server state there instead of having state on the actual server somewhere and having state in your JavaScript object somewhere and having to reconcile the two.
Well, basically what I did was I imagined, what if we had live view, but in the browser is really what it ended up being.
Live view. Yeah, live view versus live vue. I don't know how to say that. But I don't often daydream about stuff like that often. Like I don't really do that. And I thought that was fun because I wouldn't have ever thought to even think about that or explore that opportunity or possibility. So maybe that's a future we're looking at, right? With this WebAssembly stuff.
Yeah, it's just one of the things I love about coming to the conference is just getting all these different viewpoints. And also just, I think you mentioned this to me before off air, like just not thinking about work, not thinking about your own problems, not thinking about your specific problem space. It's so limited, and there's all this other stuff that people are doing out there and interesting problems they're solving, and just thinking about, is that applicable to what I'm doing? Is that cool? You know, just keeping an open mind about it. I love that aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also been really good. So people ask me like, what do you do with Elixir? You know, and I always say, oh, I just make a web app. And what's also cool is that no one's dogged me for that. I've had a couple of people over the past couple of years, like, oh, why don't you do this? Or why don't you use PHP? Or why don't you use Rails or whatever, if you're just making a web app. But you know, I guess it is an Elixir conference after all, but
it's a little bit of an echo chamber.
Sure. Sure. But everyone's like, oh, cool. Like what, you know, like what specifically, like what's your stack like, you know? And I tell them, like, trying to keep it simple. It's Elixir. It's Postgres. We just got rid of Redis for our backend. You know, we don't have that. And it's Elasticsearch, you know? It's also kind of cool, like going to talk. So for example, we both went to it was microservices and GraphQL talk. And I wasn't really paying too much close attention to the microservices stuff because it's just not really applicable to me, but I was more interested to see what they were doing with Absinthe. I can't remember the speaker's name, but they worked for Podium, I believe, was the startup. And so they basically use Absinthe in a very similar way that I do at DK, and I felt kind of validated, maybe, in a sense, because I've talked to a couple of people already. And when I mentioned Elasticsearch, they're like, oh, what do you, you know, what is that? Is that just like a cache store, or like, what do you use that for? And when we break it down with Design Collective, we really only use Elasticsearch for their faceted searching. So, you know, the smart keyword matching, the stemming, you know, like, so spelling errors or matching sofa to couch. And we use a lot of scoring. So, you know, something that matches based on arbitrary criteria would show up higher in the results, you know. And we do that via Absinthe. And so we have a products query, which gets products from the database, and we have an Elasticsearch products query, which gets products from Elasticsearch. And all of the web services just go through Elasticsearch products. And in fact, we actually build a lot of our emails with an Absinthe query on our side. So when I'm building the email, I'll have a function called build data or get data or something. And it's just a static query right in Elixir that gets the data from Elasticsearch for me, and then it returns it, and I just pipe that off to Mailgun or Postmark or something. And it was cool because Podium is doing, I guess, similar things, right? They have a bunch of different microservices, and they're used the different Absinthe resolvers to go to the applicable microservice, get the data, and stitch it back in one response.
Yeah, this was a term I hadn't heard before called BFF, backend for front end, which I just had to chuckle every time he said BFF.
Right.
But basically what they do is the BFF itself is a quote-unquote microservice, and that's your sort of the client's, the only interface that the client cares about. It doesn't care about the underlying implementation, about what other services you're talking to. It's all abstracted away through this one sort of interface, this one pipeline. And that's what you're doing with DK, right? So you're calling, you have this GraphQL interface, and the client doesn't care whether you're talking to Postgres or Elasticsearch or who knows whatever else thing you might use in the future, right? Obviously, you're not doing the full-on microservice architecture, but we kind of are, because you're using the you got that little package packing problem, PHP service.
Yeah, we
service,
have a little PHP doodad.
Right, so that's another one, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, the BFF pattern, I thought that was interesting, and like, I don't personally have any problems that require the complexities of a microservice. I can imagine taking it to its logical conclusion where like every single function call is an individual microservice, right? You could do something like that just for fun to see how far you could take it. But I don't have any practical application for this because it's the quote unquote mono repo, and being able to split up a Elixir application, and by application I'm talking about like a mix application, right? Being able to split it up first by modules and context, and then be able to split it up even further by umbrellas if you need to do that, like that gets you so far. And that's you know, I don't think I'm gonna have to go beyond that for a long time.
Yeah, I hope I don't anyway, because it's just we would just have to have more people.
Yeah, it's a lot of complexity there to manage. Yeah.
So one thing that was interesting in that same talk, the BFF stuff, was he mentioned availability and resilience, I suppose, of your service, right? And so if you have sort of a microservice setup, he kind of spun it as a plus, like, yeah, if your critical systems, and if this other tangential one goes down, your critical systems are still up, right? So you're sort of isolating the most important processes there. And I thought that was interesting because the talk right after that, which was intense, I think it was titled Elixir and CQRS, directly after that was talking about, I kind of conflated the two ideas, but, and I'll have to have you explain some more of the meat here. But so they were talking about redundancy, right? For their log entry queue. So they have a stream of logs coming in or events coming in, and they have to basically write those back to a data store. And so they talked about resilience there, and they talked about, okay, so you might have a query setup or query system and a write system, and you can actually separate those two systems, which is CQRS, which stands for, I'm trying to remember now, help me.
Command query responsibility separation.
That's right. So,
or segregation.
Yeah, depending on who you talk to, as he said. But so basically he was saying their system, the query operations and the read operations are separate, almost separate apps. And from what it looked like in the screenshots of the editor, they maybe weren't separate umbrella apps in the Elixir app that they were working on.
They were, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were separated into separate umbrella apps. And so he was like, okay, so if you have a query system and it talks to this data store and you have the read system talk to this data store, you know, you could split those into two actual separate services, right? So actual different servers in a sense. And then I think the example was, okay, so what if you split it up, but you still have to have two data stores there, right? So the data stores are still shared between them. Well, you might think that you're actually making it more resilient by splitting the services up. But what happens if the data service over here goes down? Well, it's going to affect both. So even though you split things up and you think that your availability increases, it actually decreases.
Yeah, the way he described it was if you have a system and it fails at some rate, I don't know, 1% or something. That's terrible, but right, your system fails 1% of the time, and then you have two systems. Now you've got two systems that could fail 1% of the time,
right?
And that, again, that's assuming that you don't that separation doesn't allow you to improve the quality of each system individually and, you know, make them more reliable. But yeah, it's just more points of failure. Now there's no single point of failure, but overall your availability is going to be worse. And I thought that was an interesting. It's not really a paradox. It's just a it's a non-intuitive result of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I thought comparing or like contrasting the two talks was interesting how they're talking about it. And I guess it was a little bit of a different scenario because the second talk, the CQRS talk, was talking about redundancy in actually having like different data centers essentially, or different regions, having services available in different regions. But that talk messed me up.
Yeah, this is probably my favorite talk I saw today. It was a very high-level architectural systems-oriented talk and literally no code slides at all, which is perfect in my book for this kind of talk. This was a guy from PagerDuty. Sorry, I don't have the name right here. And as Sean mentioned, they're talking about their log entries thing where they separate it out into the creation aspect where they're ingesting logs from whatever services that they're monitoring. And then the querying was basically a totally separate thing. Just in its, each system can be optimized for that. And they talked about how they split those two responsibilities up and all the benefits from that. And the big takeaway for this for me was not the technical aspect of it, because every time you go to look at CQRS or event sourcing things, they focus very heavily on the sort of weird computer science-y nomenclature for all the things and technically how you accomplish it and maybe some of the reasons why. But the biggest win for them was not so much the improved architecture of the application. Like that's a benefit. It was a good fit. And he made sure to point out that it's not a good fit for everything. You know, it was a good application for this particular problem, but they don't, it's not like they just apply it to everything they do, right? CQRS is a very specific problem domain that it solves very well, and is, you know, streaming logs and querying them turns out to be a good one. But the main benefit for him, again, was not the structure of the application, but the operational improvements in that due to this decoupling, they were able to not only like scale their data stores across multiple cloud regions, but they could optimize the individual components. So like a great example was like if you have a database, just imagine a plain old relational database, Postgres or whatever. It's very easy to set up a replica, a read-only replica, which is really good to have for downtime. So you have like a hot swappable database in case your main one goes down. It's really good because you can run backups and basically any read-only operation you can run off the replica, and you don't have to worry about impacting insertion performance. CQRS, you get that basically for free because the R, right? The reading, or the R, the Q, the querying, it's read-only. So you just, if you've got a replica, you just talk to the replica and you've basically, you know, improved your performance of your primary write database. Like that was cool. And then he had this insane thing where they wanted to migrate the underlying database system on AWS. So I don't know what they're using before. They might have just been using EC2 instances with the regular old Postgres install. And they wanted to move over to RDS, which is Amazon's managed database system. Because they were using this sort of event sourcing CQRS thing, what they did was they spun up an entire new stack of their application. They copied the data over to this new stack, and then they replayed whatever events that had been missed in that time. And basically then the databases were caught up. And then they basically redirected every message to both the old stack and the new stack. And once they verified that everything was in sync, they slowly migrated some of the traffic over to the new stack. And then at the end of the day, they just deleted the old stack with zero impact. Yeah. Like no one noticed, no tickets, no downtime. There was a really great quote in there. I think, did you write it down?
Yeah. I think if we're thinking about the same one.
About cars?
Oh, yeah. Scheduled maintenance is for cars, is not SaaS.
Yeah, that's great. So anyway, you look like you want to say something, but I just got really, really excited, and I thought sure. it was really cool, and it was nice to see those patterns talked about and implemented in a way that didn't feel like it was over my head.
Yes. So in researching the Laravel event system, I would always kind of go over to Elixir and search for events, and I would always end up running into CQRS systems that were, like you said, way over my head or felt way over my head, or really just unnecessary. And I think really what that communicates to me is maybe that's unnecessary for what I'm having to do, right? A simplified version of it, I think, still has problems. And I think you and I maybe off air talked about this, like with Laravel, you can basically have events that you can dispatch, and you have event listeners that watch for that event and they do some work, right? So it's similar to a job queue, for example. We do something similar in Design Collective, but we don't really have event listeners. We just have it's literally a list of functions and arities, and so if something runs, then it loops over, or it loops through that loop and just calls all the functions in the list, right? So if you're broadcasting and just in listening for events, like how do you handle order? Like order important there, right? And come to find out that for me, it would have been in the scenarios that I wanted to look at it. So like checkout items and receipts and different things. So that was really interesting to me, because I feel like it made the CQRS idea available to my mind to grasp. And then also at the end, he was like, you know, this isn't an end-all be-all solution for everything. This fits good for the problem that we had, because it's, I think he said when they swapped the database out, it was the largest data store they had at PagerDuty. It was the biggest database they had. And I think maybe one of the cooler slides he had was, and no one noticed, and nobody even knew that we did it besides the team that needed to know about it, right? So no customers knew. The salespeople didn't know. Nobody knew. There's no downtime, nothing. And I think they did the same operational approach for fixing a bug too, right? So they had some sort of corrupted message come in and it caused things to back up. And so they're trying to fix it. Oh, he had this other slide that he wanted to make. He said he wanted people to share it because it would get people to watch the talk. It was, I don't know it exactly, but it was something along the lines of the production environment is the only real test environment, or the most important test environment, or something like that. And so on a system of that scale and as many events they receive, I imagine it's got to be just an obscene amount. Like, how do you test that, and how do you verify a bug is actually fixed? And he was like, the only way is in production to do that. And so what they did was to get, like you said, they spun up a separate instance in a region. They proxied some traffic over to it and just watched what happened. And then turns out the first fix that they thought would work didn't really work. So they patched it, put up a new instance of it, piped traffic over to it. It was good. They pushed the rest of the track over to it and deleted the old instance. Just gone. You know, that, I don't know, it's pretty cool. It's hard for me to even wrap my head around a lot of that stuff because it's such a problem that's so far away from anything that I deal with, but it was very cool to hear about.
Yeah, the scale that you and I deal with is minuscule compared to this, and obviously we have limited resources as well. I mean, if we had, it would be, you and I were lamenting the fact that we don't work on larger teams. Like we really have the benefit of the autonomy and small scale and, you know, all the benefits of what we do. But we really do miss out on these really high level, big architectural projects that we can contribute to and are really, really cool and you can learn from. And I do kind of miss that, you know. I mean, at Agilent, I was a small cog in a very big machine, and but it was, at the end of the day, I did eventually, you know, get to see my tiny little product that I developed, like, being used, you know, in customers' hands, and being able to work with people who are extremely smart and building really complicated things. It's a really great learning experience, and it is really rewarding. So I do kind of miss that, but it's cool to hear from other people's experiences and at least learn from it if we can't be in that environment all the time.
Yeah, it's been a really nice change of pace for me, I think. It's easy for me, especially working from home, being the only tech person, to kind of get lost in the day-to-day, not really feel like super productive, not really feel like I'm growing, I think maybe is the way I can put it best. Like, feeling stagnant maybe is a good way to put it. And, you know, I've been reading books, but maybe, so I feel like, I guess I always relate things back to, like, I relate learning things back to music because that's the experience that I have. But when I was learning music and playing guitar, it's not really like a linear growth. You got growth and then you plateau for a while. You got growth and you plateau. I guess it's like working out, like running, trying to get faster, trying to lift weights. You hit these plateaus, and it's such a grind to get through the plateaus. And like with music and with working out, what I found that works for me is just changing it up. And so this is maybe a good instance of just changing it up. So I'm glad you encouraged me to come here, because I feel like maybe I'm starting to finally get over the plateau. And I'm starting to realize that in just talking with people I have never met before, explaining what I'm working on and the problems that I'm solving. And they're like, oh, that makes sense. That's cool. You know, because for whatever reason, I always feel like people are going to have some sort of criticism or, I would do it this way, or you should do that differently, or whatever. But instead it's people like, yeah, that's sensible, you know, and that, makes me maybe feel like I'm farther along than I think that I am.
I also really like talking to people who have come to the same conclusions, seemingly totally independent of me. You know, it's like how different civilizations developed boats at all around the same time, or like ships or something. Mm-hmm. And there's really no explanation because they're so disparate, and it's not like they had communication. They just all happened to develop it at the same time. And I feel like that when I'm talking to people sometimes. It's like, oh, we use GraphQL for this and that, and here's the advantages, and this is why I love it. And I'm like, are you me?
Right.
It's and like Jake, I was talking with Jake, he has a company that he runs in Taiwan that does consulting, and he manages two dozen clients. And he's using the exact same tools that we're using for the exact same reason. And it fits his business perfectly. So that's, mm-hmm. Seeing that is cool.
Yeah, it is. It is. I guess I also liked just hearing... Again, I keep going back to like the mentioning the stories of like people that have been using Erlang for a while, or just different times, you know. Like last night we were talking about Perl, reminiscing about Perl. I'd never written it, but we were hanging out with Jake and Brian, who had both had Perl experience. And what the funniest thing to me was, I think you asked something along the lines of like, so why, you know, when would I use Perl? And they both at the same time, they both said you wouldn't.
Yeah, never.
Right. But they're talking about Perl. They're talking about Visual Basic for a little bit. Talking about just all these different languages from a while ago. I don't know. I really enjoy conversations like that. I'd love to have Jake on sometime and just let him talk about the last, you know, 10 or 15 years or whatever.
Well, Sean and I got to book it downstairs so we can watch. I think Jose's doing the keynote.
Oh, I haven't even cited Jose yet.
Really? I had a Chris and a Jose sighting.
Were they both like, what did I ask you last year? If they were like floating on air?
Yeah, their feet are just a couple inches off the ground.
Right. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to tomorrow too. And obviously we'll have a second show where we talk about the second day of ElixirConf and our notes and things like that. But yeah, I'm glad that you convinced me to come out, and I'll definitely be coming to some more conferences.
Yeah, definitely. I was telling someone about the METAR map that I had worked on a couple months ago.
Oh, right.
And this is Emily, and she's like, do you like going to conferences? There's this great map conference just for cartographers. And I'm like, I guess. I mean, maps are cool. You really like go to a conference that far out of your out front of your, you know, that far outside of your comfort zone. I mean, can you imagine going to a conference and know nothing about it and just walk up to someone and be like, hey, I don't know anything, and how excited they would be to like tell you everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun experience.
Yeah, I think my favorite thing that she said to you was the world needs to see your map.
I already posted it.
More of the world needs to see your map.
It's open source. You can make your own.
Well. I also wanted to, I went and looked up the names of the speakers for the talks.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So the CQRS talk was by John Griman, I want to say, from PagerDuty. The GraphQL talk was by Donald Ford from Podium. And the keynote was by Brian Cardarella, Luke Imhoff, and Paul Schoenfelder from Dockyard.
Didn't butcher any of those names.
I didn't.
But, and also, it's amazing, the talks from this morning are already uploaded. So we will post links to all those in the show notes, and you can check them out.
Yep. Well, if anybody has any feedback, any questions, or anything else, maybe you want to see some of the notes we took. They're not great, but I can format them up a little nicer. We'd be happy to share them with you. And just reach out and ask, and we'll get that to you.
You can, as always, you can reach us at DNC Show on Twitter. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I'm Shrockwell.
And as always, like I mentioned a few times, our show notes are going to be available at dnc.show. We'll put as much stuff as we can there, and I'm going to be linking specifically to some timestamps on a YouTube video, specifically showing the WebAssembly demos from the keynote.
Yeah, those are really, really cool. We'll also post those over on spectrum.chat, where you can stop in and say hi and have discussions with us about the show as well.
And thanks to Spec for having us and supporting us and putting us out there into the world. And if you're into other design and development related shows, head on over to spec.fm to see what's going on over there.
This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. I was going to say see you, but I already am seeing you.
Oh, for the second time. See ya.
Bye.